Let us reflect, O God, on the wondrous gift that you gave us and how it's manifested in the way people give each other love and themselves. Amen. So the song says, how silently the wondrous gift is given. So God imparts to human hearts the blessings of his heaven. No ear may hear his coming, but in this world of sin, where meek souls will receive him, still the dear Christ enters in. There was a headline in the UCC News that read, Douglas, Michigan church quadruples in size by ministering to the community. In 2014, the Douglas UCC congregation numbered fewer than 30. Now it's up to more than 130. And people attribute their growth to being a visible presence in the community. As we've been growing, they said, people want to take our mission and bring it outside the church. It's more than Sunday morning. The Reverend Sapienza is a former Catholic brother, innkeeper, and ordained interfaith minister who taught himself how to be a UCC person and taught the congregation as well. So they have a Stephen minister that goes out into the community. Some of the members have become volunteers as tutors in the elementary school. They have become a Creation Justice Church, done beach cleanups on shores of Lake Michigan. They just don't stop. And the comments that have come from the congregants are, I like focusing on living like Jesus instead of merely worshiping. We didn't feel welcomed. No, we felt embraced. Each week, we leave Douglas UCC truly intent on trying to live fully, love wastefully, and to be the person God created me to be. So Douglas UCC got the message and is spreading and sharing the wondrous gift. But did the gift have to be a baby? In her book, Bread of Angels, Barbara Brown Taylor writes that God started having trouble with people about the time they, disobeyed in the garden. And although God still loved them, that love wasn't being reciprocated. The other creatures, hummingbirds, cows, bears, they adored God. People, not so much. People were busy learning how to grow things, make things, sell things, buy things, and so they depended less on God. And it wasn't long before humans mostly forgot about him. They honestly believed they had created themselves. And Barbara Brown Taylor said, when he'd made human beings, unfortunately or fortunately, God made them free. Well, so God started trying things. God shouted to them from the sidelines using every means he could think of. Floods, famines, messengers, manna. He got inside people's dreams. And if that didn't work, he woke them up in the middle of the night, whispering. No matter how and what God tried, he came up against the barriers of flesh and blood. They were made of it. And he was not. And that made the translation difficult. And so God would say, please stop before you destroy yourselves. And all they heard was thunder. He would say, I love you. I love you as much now as the day I made you. But all they heard was a loon calling across the water. Babies, though, babies were the exception. Now, this is Barbara Brown Taylor's words, okay? Were the exception to this sad state of affairs. While their parents were all but deaf to God's messages, babies did not have any trouble hearing God at all. They were all the time laughing at God's jokes or crying with him when he cried, which went right over their parents' heads. Colic, the grown-ups would say. Or, isn't she cute? Almost everyone seemed to love babies. And that gave God the idea. why not create himself as one of these delightful creatures? Oh, God's advisors and archangels were concerned for God. God would be putting himself at the mercy of his creatures. There would be no escape for him if things turned sour. Maybe they suggested, could he at least create himself as a magical baby with special powers? Although the baby idea was a stroke of genius, they admitted, it lacked adequate safety features. But God decided to just be a regular baby. How else could he gain the trust of his creatures? How else could he persuade them that he knew their lives inside out unless he lived one like theirs? There was a high risk, but that was part of what he wanted his creatures to know, that he was willing to risk everything to get close to them in hopes that they might love him again. And so God became a human baby. What next? Well, Enid read all the story, and I will kind of paraphrase it back. The shepherds, the sheep, the angels, and the heavenly host have gone away, and Joseph and Mary now have this baby to raise. And the writer of Luke's gospel tells us that Jesus' parents did follow the law of Moses, and so they took Jesus first for circumcision and naming, and then after the appropriate time had passed, they've come to the temple in Jerusalem for Mary's purification and Jesus' presentation as a firstborn male to be consecrated to God. And then as they entered the temple, they came upon Anna and Simeon. They were ancient and devout and prayerful, and they had become experts in the art of waiting. That's hard for kids, and it gets easier, I think, as people get older. And so they were waiting for God's promises to be fulfilled. And Simeon took Jesus in his arms, and he saw the salvation of God, glory for the people of Israel, and light for the Gentiles. Reverend Catherine Matthews says that Simeon is a good example for us of someone who sees with his heart and soul and mind. It's as if he stood there and felt the presence of God's promise about to be fulfilled. He was open, as we should be, to what is yet to come. What if each of us could see the Christ in every single person we meet? Just imagine it. So God became a gift, a perpetual gift, priceless, over the top, extravagant. Now, my last piece comes from a story called Captive Hearts. And it was written last year, I believe. A story about a gift of the heart, love and compassion, a gift that came from God. Water time, excuse me. And it was set in Montana State Prison in Deer Lodge. The author was William Bonham. And this is an excerpt from a book. He wrote of a man named Whitegrass who had spent much of his life at that prison. The man Whitegrass had been when he entered the prison years ago had long since disappeared. The man lived in twilight now, beyond any kind of punishment for whatever it was he had done. Whitegrass had the look of an old warrior. He had a broad, flat face, high cheekbones. His skin was brown, his face deeply lined. He often combed his long gray and black hair into a ponytail. He had no teeth. When he sat with his arms crossed, you might have thought he was a wise tribal elder. Only his eyes gave away the damaged man behind them. Some days the eyes were vacant. Others, they held the innocence of a child. Most of the convicts there and the guards were gentle with him. Many even watched over him. And this went on for years. One day in late April or May, a few hours after the morning meal, the author went to the walk-in refrigerator and found Whitegrass there, bent over, pulling leaves from a head of lettuce. When I entered, he looked up at the author, with an expression I'd never seen. Happiness. Real happiness, vibrant and alive. A lost part of Whitegrass had bobbed to the surface. "What are you doing?" I asked. He showed me the lettuce. "It's for the babies," he said. "What babies?" "The babies," he repeated. "Come look." A pregnant skunk had crawled beneath the prison kitchen and given birth. I went to the door and peeked out, and Whitegrass was a few feet off to the right, dropping bits of lettuce into the recessed area along the wall. And he was talking to the mother. "There you go. Mama's hungry. Sure she is." Whitegrass stayed outside most of that morning, sometimes coming into the kitchen for more lettuce or cabbage, far more than the mother could have eaten. He acted like a proud father, busy, excited. That afternoon, before I got off my shift, I made my rounds of the kitchen, which included checking out the area by the garbage cans. And Whitegrass knelt there still, down on one knee, cooing to the mother. His delight was a lovely thing to see. As I left for the day, Lieutenant Burns said, "We've got to get rid of him." And the author wrote, "I can't fathom now how I missed the import of that sentence." Because that night, someone at the prison poisoned the mother skunk and the babies. The next morning, Whitegrass found the bodies. In the morning when I arrived, I heard a horrible, gut-wrenching wailing. "Who's making that noise?" I said. "Whitegrass," the guard replied. "He's been doing that all morning." I didn't need to ask why. If only I'd been smarter the day before. If I'd been thinking, I would have told Lieutenant Burns that the death of the skunks could have killed Whitegrass. Burns was a hard man, but he wasn't cruel. We could have lied. We could have lied to him. It would have been easy. Whitegrass was so childlike. We could have removed the bodies and told him the mother skunk had taken her babies deep into the forest, and he would have believed it. Poor Whitegrass. We stood watching Whitegrass about 20 feet away. He remained still, standing, his back arched, his face tilted up to the sun. His long hair fell loosely behind him, and his arms open to the sky. Tears ran down his cheeks as he shook his head back and forth. And like a child, he brought his hands to his face and dug the heels of his palms into his eyes, crushing the tears. Whitegrass needed help, and I knew it had to come from someone smarter than me, or Charlie, or the desk sergeant. So I asked Charlie if he called anybody. He said, "Hegstead's coming." Hegstead was the prison chaplain. He is small, older man, with a few wonderfully snowy hairs crossing a balding pink scalp. Can you just picture that? I never had any doubt that he was a man of genuine faith called to a hard ministry, but he was a pest. I'd had to throw him out of the kitchen several times for trying to start a prayer group. If I turned my back on him, he'd sneak into the office with a convict and start a counseling session, and I'd have to chuck him out again. I returned to the kitchen, frustrated that Hegstead was the best the prison had to offer. didn't know what Whitegrass needed exactly. A tribal ritual? A psychiatrist? A sedative? But I was certain he did not need an old Protestant minister. It might have been 20 minutes before the chaplain arrived. Dressed in his worn black suit, he was solemn and subdued. He walked to within a few feet of Whitegrass. I was afraid he was going to launch into a sermon or force Whitegrass to his knees to pray, but he didn't. He said, "I'm so sorry, Whitegrass. I'm so sorry." That's it, those words, simple, heartfelt. His voice was full of genuine sorrow and compassion. Whitegrass yelled again. Hegstead whispered to him and stood where he was, a gentle presence just a few feet away. Whitegrass covered his face with his palms and his head moved so slowly back and forth. And then Hegstead took a few steps forward and put a hand on Whitegrass's back. The two, Whitegrass and Reverend Hegstead, stood over the mother's skunk's den, silent. The sad old Indian and the white-haired Protestant minister held hands, looking down at the bodies. Hegstead spent the day there comforting Whitegrass, and late in the afternoon, they came inside and sat at a table in the dining hall. A few of the convicts on the kitchen crew paid their respects, patting Whitegrass on the shoulder and saying how sorry they were about the skunks. Whitegrass didn't look up. At times, he would start to weep again, and Hegstead would say something soft to him or simply put a hand on his shoulder. And somehow, over the hours, he led Whitegrass to still waters. Please join me in prayer. How silently, the wondrous gift is given. I would be silent now, Lord, and expectant that I may receive the gift I need so that I may become a gift to others. Amen.